Hello, you're listening to On the Point, the News Collective's show, formerly known as Democracy Watch, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Isaac Yu.
I'm Grace Jenkins.
And I'm Akshay Kulkarni. It's Friday, December the 11th. We're broadcasting remotely nowadays, but we're based on UBC's Vancouver campus, on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Today we've got an interview with Harsha Walia, Executive Director of the BCCLA, to talk about the new 2021 police budget that was voted on by the Vancouver City Council.
We've also got a regular COVID talk programming, but first, Akshay, let's talk about your piece about the VPD budget.
So 2 days ago now, Vancouver City Council passed a motion to freeze the policing budget at 2020 levels, so basically, you know, what it was this year. And that's still around $340 million. This means there won't be an increase, but the VPD still swallows up 20% of the city's budget as a whole. So I wanted to find out more about what this might mean for policing in Vancouver, you know, especially since we talked recently about the new community policing team and, you know, so many other things. So yeah, that's why I wanted to find out.
Yeah, I also remember the council passing motions to decriminalize drugs and poverty, all because of the protests in the summer around police brutality.
Yeah, so it seems like the police are under quite a scanner in Vancouver recently. So, yeah, I spoke to two people about this. First, as Grace mentioned, Harsha Walia. She's the executive director of the BC Civil Liberties Association. And I spoke to her about the larger context the VPD operates under and what the move to freeze the budget might mean. And I also spoke to Flora Monroe, she's a board member of the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, about what the new community team means for people on the ground in the downtown east side and beyond. And in the piece, there's also an email statement that I read out from the VPD themselves. So I spoke to quite a few people for this. And just a fair warning, both the interviewees whose voices you hear, their audio quality is pretty bad, but that's just... That's the nature of radio in 2020, I guess. So just keep that in mind and I hope you enjoy.
Sounds good. Let's take a listen.
A few days ago, Vancouver City Council voted to freeze its 2021 policing budget at the same levels that it was in 2020, rejecting a $6 million increase requested by the police board. That may seem like a good step after months and months of protest to defund the VPD. However, council also rejected a move by Councillor Jean Swanson to remove $5 million from this budget. So the framing that the VPD lost some money really isn't true here. How exactly have the VPD responded to the months of unrest around its use and service to us as a society? And what about its new community policing team that they created due to apparent concern from Vancouverites over the summer? I wanted to find out about all of this. That's why I decided to talk to Harsha Walia, Executive Director of the BC Civil Liberties Association. I spoke to her about many things, but the first thing I asked her about was that new community policing team. The VPD created the community policing team in early November after they commissioned a survey which showed that the majority of the people they surveyed were concerned about crime in Vancouver. However, there are a few things about the survey that stuck out to me. First, more than half of the respondents lived outside Vancouver. And secondly, there was no clarity about what concern exactly meant. It seems like the VPD cooked this team up for some reason or the other. So I asked Harsha Walia why this might be the case.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're in the middle of a global movement where people are challenging the police in different ways, whether it's calls to abolish the police, calls to defund the police, and just the general scrutiny of policing, even in mainstream newspapers. So, for example, in the context of Canadian newspapers, you know, there's frequent stories about even issues like lack of police accountability, police independence, you know, police violence and wellness checks. So there's, you know, just cops are under the microscope. So I think, you know, the police do actually do this every year. I should say that every year when it comes to budget time towards the end of the year, the police kind of cook up justifications for why they need budget increases. So this does happen often. I think it's just often fallen under the radar. But I think especially this year, you know, they really have to work for their money, right? We're in a context where this Vancouver City Council passed a motion to ban street checks. They passed a motion to decriminalize poverty. And, you know, Vancouver City Council was forced to do so because there was so much pressure on them. So the police felt they had to justify the expansion of their budget. And that included this new low crime unit, which is exactly as you pointed out, it's cooked up. The entire premise of it is completely both false and flawed. You know, and every example that they gave of what the low crime unit would do has nothing to do with policing, right? They're talking about people sleeping in doorways. They're talking about public consumption of and use of substances. They're talking about people sleeping on a sidewalk, people sleeping in parks. All of that has to do with social inequality and oppression, right? It has to do with race, it has to do with class, and it has to do with the criminalization of racialized people who live in poverty, especially. So nothing about that has to do with crime. It has to do with them creating crime by criminalizing poverty. And, you know, I think we have to also be really aware that this is we often think that we're better than the United States, but this is like exactly the model of broken windows policing that has now actually been discredited in the United States because it's the 80s era of Reagan and Nixon and what was called broken windows policing, which is like police literally created crime by being present, right? So, you know, there would be like an occupying force in low-income racialized neighborhoods, particularly Black and Puerto Rican neighborhoods in the United States. And suddenly crime would increase, not because people are doing more crime, but because they're like, oh, look, you jaywalked. Oh, look, you littered. Oh, look, you know, three Black youth on a street corner. That's loitering. That's vagrancy. Whatever thing they would cook up, like minor bylaw infractions. Or, you know, you put a cigarette butt out on the street. Things that happen in every neighborhood that never get characterized as crime because they're simply not visible. So these kinds of units, you know, they're based on false pretenses of crime, but we also have to look at the ways in which they then create crime, right? So once they get this low unit, once they get this low crime unit going, next year they're going to be like, oh, look, in this neighborhood, crime went up because we ticketed this many people, right? We arrested this many people. So it's like a pipeline to more criminalization.
The new community team has already been controversial and has already seen complaint letters from Pivot Legal and the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users. Ms. Walia did tell me about how exactly that looks like for people on the ground, but I wanted to find out more. So that's why I talked to Flora Monroe, who's a board member at the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users. She spoke to me about how exactly the new community team affects people on the ground, and also whether they had even been consulted when the new team was formed.
I haven't spoken to anybody, as far as I know. Nobody, like, even here, nobody has been spoken to anything about this other than the ones we speak to about decriminalizing, and that's that. It's just, like, what we can do to help. Like, you know, how long ago had they done decriminalizing all this stuff downtown, and now they're bringing it back up again? Like, what is it, like? What are they doing? Like, they're playing with people's lives here, from one thing of saying this and then turning it around and doing it all over again. Like, some kind of, what is it, some kind of intimidation tactics on their part? They're picking on people that are already down and out. Like, how much further do they want to go down?
For its part, the VPD claimed that the survey that led to the community policing team was representative of the lower mainland as a whole. In an email statement, Tanya Visintin of the VPD confirmed to me that the survey was representative based on 2016 census demographics. However, when I followed up with the survey company about whether it was also representative based on household earning, they confirmed that it was not. That may be exactly why the VPD did not consult drug users when creating the new team. The VPD has had a few setbacks in recent months, however. The council passed motions decriminalizing poverty, something that Flora Monroe just mentioned. And there were also moves to reallocate money to more community safety initiatives. But Harsha Walia is a little more skeptical about whether this will prove to be a check on the VPD.
I think the thing that will actually happen if council passes, refuses their budget increase, actually, and passes a motion to deny that budget, it will actually go to the province. So it won't be a done deal right away, right? So under the Police Act, the province will likely get involved because it will be seen as a conflict between the police board and the city council. And that would then be a matter within the Police Act for the province to resolve, which I think is an important question, right? I think that is a question that should be put to the province, right? Like, who has the authority? The city council technically has the authority to pass a budget. Why should they pass the budget of the Vancouver Police Board? But I do think the cops will see that as an affront, right? Because it's not actually about the 1% or the dollar amount. It's about their ability to amass power and their ability to amass a power without any accountability. And so I do not think that they will take it lying down. I might be proven wrong. Maybe they'll actually pretend that they're so humanitarian and they're like, actually, yeah, who knows? But I don't think so. Because they do see that as a challenge to their power. I think the things that are important to keep in mind, though, is how policing kind of reconfigures itself, right? So one thing that we have seen is that as the defund movement has grown and there's calls on the kind of public institutions like city council and the police board to reject the budget, and, you know, where people are speaking as like, you know, I'm a resident of a Vancouver, like I have a right to say what happens in my city, that the police are turning to things like the private foundation. So the Vancouver police have a private foundation called the Vancouver Police Foundation, where any money that's put into that is above and beyond their operating budget. So, you know, then that kind of leads to the question, like, okay, suppose the cops do get their budget cut, and then they just start to privately raise money through even more unaccountable means through this private foundation. And then they'll get millions of dollars through that avenue, right? So I think we have to always be mindful about the many ways in which policing power reconfigures itself and how it will very quickly adapt. State power always reconfigures and adapts itself, right, to social movements. That's the constant battle. So I think we have to be very aware and attuned to the ways in which different kinds of partnerships and collaborations may emerge where police do actually retain their power, even if they experience a budget cut.
Given the moves recently by council to decriminalize poverty and not agree to the police budget increase, among so many other things, I had a thought. How would the Vancouver Police Department respond to this? Since they consume almost 20% of the city's budget, would they try to push through things to shore up that power?
I think the thing with policing, though, is that they don't have to push through anything, right? Like, they already operate with such impunity. The only thing that's even vaguely kind of allows public participation, if you will, is budget decisions. But, you know, there is nothing they have to push through with respect to their policies. That's all happens at the board and the provincial level, the Vancouver Police Board and provincial level, or their own internal guidelines. It's impossible to make complaints about them. You know, the procedure is so opaque, and of course, many of them don't go anywhere. And policy complaints like ours got closed. And, you know, this now there's whole controversy around the Street Check report review where they basically censored racism in the report. And it's so blatant. And yet they're like, oh, we're still an independent. Like, it's mind-boggling and insulting, right? But I think that's the level of impunity that they're working with. Like, they don't even have the minimal kind of representational politics that they have to abide by, the minimal kind of democratic standards of being elected and such. And so I think that's where the more rigorous review at the provincial level is important, right? Which is like, how do institutions like the Vancouver Police Board get constituted? They're supposed to be the civilian governance oversight body over the police. It is clear that they have deep loyalties to the police, right? They accept whatever budget the cops want. They say that they're independent and, you know, they release independent reports to the police, and then the police are allowed to interfere in those complaints, like the Street Check Review report. So those are the kinds of places where I'd be curious to see where social movements, if that's a place where people want to put pressure into, right? It's like, city council doesn't actually have governance authority over the Vancouver police. The board does, but the board is completely loyal So is it possible, like places in the United States where police boards are democratically elected, where that can happen? But then, you know, it's a double-edged sword, because then you don't want to, you know, you don't want to give a facade of a democratic institution over something that's fundamentally, like, it feels like it's a reform that is potentially useful, but ultimately not really that useful, because ultimately we need to reduce the scale and scope of policing, right? So just more governance, even if it's better, doesn't change that radically. So that's where the stuff around governance, I think, can be a double-edged sword sometimes.
I wanted to then zoom out a little bit and talk exactly about how the VPD has been operating when it comes to their messaging around the community safety team and around policing in general in 2020. A lot of it has relied on this narrative of safety, something that came up a lot in the survey that I mentioned earlier. What exactly does safety mean in this context? And how did it become such a popular buzzword for police departments across the globe?
I think it's so important to see policing in its historical context. And, you know, this is a global context, right? Again, oftentimes we default to kind of U.S. exceptionalism. But policing as a global institution has its roots in empire. It has its roots in empire, specifically on these lands in settler colonial empire, but across the world in policing of empire, and also specifically enslavement. And so if we look at it in a global context, you know, how did colonial empires enforce massive populations and their repression? Policing was one of those tactics, right? The Irish model of policing, for example, really instituted and brought in the use of horses and the use of animals as a tactic that coincides with policing. So, I mean, there's a lot more, but we have to really understand how policing has always been about enforcement, not safety. It's fundamentally about power, but the ways in which it started to evolve into a narrative of safety was very racialized, gendered, and class, right? Where it was, you know, in, for example, the enforcement of enslavement and anti-Black policing, the narrative of safety became coupled with the safety of white people, right? Because in order to, part of the specter of anti-Blackness is very much the narrative of threat, danger, criminal, et cetera. And so policing became both a tool of enforcement, but its kind of seemingly humanitarian arm became that of safety. And this is no different than humanitarian imperialism globally, right? Like when we wage wars, when the war in Afghanistan, we have to make these links, right? When the occupation of Afghanistan was led by the US and NATO forces, one of the things we were told is like, oh, this is to actually keep Afghan women safe. And so the ways in which we can often see through militarism, when they pretend militarism is about humanitarianism, policing is the same. It actually has nothing to do with safety or humanitarian concerns. It has everything to do with enforcement. And safety is the cover that we're given. And, you know, I think it's very important that you ask that question, because it is so important that we de-link policing from safety, because people who are advocating against police are actually the ones who are concerned about safety, right? Like, we are concerned about the safety of that person who's sleeping on the street. We are concerned about the safety of sex workers who are being criminalized. We are concerned about the safety of homeless people who are being criminalized. We are concerned about the safety of Black and Indigenous people who are being shot and killed across this country. We are concerned about survivors of domestic and gendered violence, because the cops don't actually do anything in those instances. The folks who are advocating against police are the ones who are actually concerned about safety, because we see the police as actually making the safety of people much worse, right? They're making it harder for people to live, literally. So that's how I think that narrative of safety has been spun, and why it's so important to actually center safety in conversations in anti-policing, because we're the ones who are actually concerned about safety, not the cops.
My last question to Harsha Walia was about the future of the Defund the Police movement. We didn't see the sort of large-scale protests in Vancouver as we saw in the US. But the role of policing in society has never been more in question, especially with what went down in council recently. So how might the future of the social movements look as the role of police around the globe is questioned?
I mean, I think even if there hasn't been those kinds of large-scale protests in Vancouver this year, I think Vancouver actually has a very old arc of work against policing, even if it doesn't take the framework or the slogan of defund police. And I think, you know, for example, we look to just the decades of work that Indigenous women in the city have led about the ways in which police have been a crucial part of the problem of gendered colonial violence and missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls and trans and two-spirit people. Policing has always been part of that crisis and that conversation and the movements that Indigenous women and girls and trans and two-spirit people have led on in this city and on these lands. So I think it is really important to have a historical lens on the ways in which our city has talked about policing. And in the same way that neighborhoods like the downtown East Side, whether that's drug user organizations or anti-poverty organizations or women's organizations, have always had protests and movements that are fundamentally anti-police, right? Because the police are an occupying force in the downtown East Side. It's hard to miss it. They're literally on every block. And so I think that's an important part of Vancouver's kind of social movement history that is important, I think, to keep in mind, is that even if, I don't think it will, but even if for some reason, because movements have ebbs and flows, even if there's an ebb in the kind of, you know, big banner of defund the police or defund the VPD, I think it's really important for us to all be aware of those communities in which conversations about criminalization are always happening. The other part that I will point to that I think is really important about the Lower Mainland is that, you know, the Lower Mainland is home to a number of different communities who have long been criminalized by the Canadian state under the banner of anti-terrorism, right? So whether that's Sikh communities, Palestinian communities, Tamil communities, Somali communities, and more, Kurdish communities. And so, you know, these are communities who have also for, you know, a long time, but especially in the post 9/11 climate, been dealing with what criminalization as a whole looks like, right? If not by the police, but by the state. And so these are also communities whose work around criminalization predates the defund movement. And I think that part is important because I think it's important not only to think about defund the police in the context of policing, but to think about the many ways in which criminalization is occurring, right? It includes the national security state apparatus. It includes the way in which social workers are apprehending Indigenous children disproportionately. It includes the cops on the street. It includes border enforcement. So there's all these tentacles to policing. That's the broader project of criminalization. And I think what I'm hopeful about is that regardless of the defund movement, we will start to make these bigger connections about state violence.
Thank you so much for listening. And to my two interviewees, Harsha Walia and Flora Munro of the BCCLA and Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, respectively. This piece was written and produced by me, Akshay Kulkarni.
Who we view as the most authoritative and electable is rooted in systems of oppression.
There are so many inequities around having our experts in our community speak about our work.
Obviously, there are several facets to this strangely homogenous nature of the electoral system.
And to be left out of conversations, it only exemplifies that loss of self-esteem.
Check out CITR's live panel podcast, Conversations, hosted by our Indigenous, Accessibility, and Gender Empowerment collectives. Subscribe to Conversations, available now on iTunes.
Atira Women's Resource Society supports women and children impacted by violence by building and operating a range of safe, affordable housing and related support services, including childcare centers. Atira has housing and programs across the Lower Mainland. Our feminism is inclusive and intersectional. We envision a world free of inequalities where everyone's human rights are respected and where women and girls have the right to participate fully and effectively in all of the decisions that affect their lives. To find out how you can help, please visit our website at atira.bc.ca or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Free of Violence.
Welcome back to On the Point by CITR 101.9 FM, your source of alternative and undercover news from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. You just heard an interview with Harsha Walia about the 2021 police budget for the city of Vancouver. Now let's talk COVID numbers.
As we know, BC has extended its COVID-19 restrictions to January 8th, 2021. BC health officials announced 723 new cases of COVID-19 on Thursday, and 28 more deaths, the highest number of deaths in a 24-hour period since the start of the pandemic. We're about to head into winter break here at UBC. The holidays are going to look very different this year. How is everyone planning on spending them in light of the pandemic?
And another thing we must mention is obviously the vaccines will be making their way into BC soon. The first set of vaccines, so obviously there's a phased approach to this, so the healthcare professionals will be getting them first. I believe the first set of vaccines is set to arrive next week. There'll be two sites in Vancouver Coastal Health and Fraser Health Regions. Bonnie Henry actually hasn't disclosed where the vaccines will even be, because apparently there's safety concerns about, you know, people maybe interfering with it, which says all you need to know about how, you know, the attitudes of people towards vaccines, really. But yeah, so that's just something we must mention here. As for how I'm spending time, I am just going to be at home, because restrictions mean I can't go anywhere. And it's not like I really want to, because I don't feel the need to do that to myself. So I'm just going to be spending it at home, listening to not the same Christmas songs, but some cool indie things that I have found. And also, I'm going to be playing some weird Japanese games and watching indie movies. That's my plan for the holidays, such as they are. Another thing we must mention is the UBC extended its winter break by 1 week. So that's more time for me to do all of the stuff that I just mentioned. So that's great. How are you all going to be spending your holidays?
Probably going to be on a long phone call with my family. On Christmas, at least. Setting up Zoom calls with friends. And taking advantage of the break to catch up on some sleep.
Wait, I wanted to ask earlier. When you say there were safety concerns, was the concern anti-vaxxers, or were they concerned people were going to try and steal the vaccines?
I believe it's the latter. I'm going to have to look it up. Because there was an Interpol warning about people trying to sell vaccines in the black market. So let me just confirm, just to be 100% sure. Yeah.
Wow. Intense. As for me, I will be biking. I've been biking a lot. The weather is like awful for biking, but like when it's not rainy, I bike. And then I will also be just like hanging around with my family, because I moved home. Probably, oh, my mom's birthday is coming up, so I'm excited for that, because I love cake, and TNT makes the best birthday cake. And then probably just like movie screenings with my friends, like online, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah, nothing too exciting.
Just to follow up, so this is, I'm reading a tweet from Kelvin Gawley, the reporter at News 1130. So he says, yesterday, Public Health Officer Dr. Henry said she's keeping the location of COVID-19 vaccine clinics secret because she had credible information from sources nationally and internationally that there are people who are targeting vaccines. And, you know, just over a week ago, Interpol warned of an organized crime threat to COVID-19 vaccines. So essentially, they don't want smugglers or someone to get a hold of it. Although I really doubt that would be happening, especially at this early stage. Maybe that might be a concern as vaccines become more widespread. But yeah, that's the reason the clinics are being kept secret. And in any case, it's not like the wider public is going to receive the vaccines immediately. So yeah. What movies are you planning to watch? Any idea? Just the same Christmas stuff? Grinch? Nightmare Christmas, all that stuff. Okay.
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and Frosty the Snowman are like some nostalgic picks. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer has not aged super well. There's some problematic stuff in it, but it is from the 1950s. What other movies? Nightmare Before Christmas.
What carols, though?
No, I...
Wait, what?
I'm so confused. Who are you talking to?
Sound cut off for me, I think. I just heard the word carols. This is all going to make for fantastic radio.
Yeah, I know. We're truly, really leaning into the journalism here. But, no, I said carol as in the lesbian movie. Based on The Price of Salt.
I literally have not heard of this movie, so...
You should watch it, dude. It's I wouldn't say it's, like, good, but it's, like, the bar is so low for LGBTQ movies in terms of, like, what's available. But it's pretty good. I love the aesthetics. It's very, like, old NYC kind of, like, I don't know. It's a cute aesthetic for
If Christmas. You watch it in December, does that make it a Christmas carol?
Fantastic. You can cut out the rest of this, but please keep that in. That was fantastic. Yeah, I'm just planning to... I mean, Christmas, it was never a thing for me growing up. So, like, I'm just glad for the break. I'm not really celebrating the birth of our Lord above or whatever. That didn't even happen in December, probably. So, you know. Yeah. I wanted to talk about something that has been brought up a lot as we approach the end of the year is BC's first wave response versus second wave, right? Because obviously BC sort of was not affected as badly during the first wave of COVID-19 around April time as the rest of Canada was. But in the second wave, it's almost been one of the leaders, especially when it comes to per capita cases, right? And at the start of the pandemic, like, you know, Dr. Bonnie Henry was, you know, all over the news. She was great. You know, everyone loved her and all that. But now, as we mentioned a few weeks ago, the sheen has sort of worn off, especially for when it comes to long-term care and, you know, schools. So my question really is, do you think BC got lucky with the first wave, or was it a good, like, just a nature of good policy that we managed to avoid as big of a catastrophe as there was elsewhere? Like, what was it, luck? Was it something else?
I would wager a guess that it's probably a bit of luck and a bit of good policy.
Yeah, I'm definitely leaning luck. I feel like we weren't really ready. Because I remember, like, a few days even before, like, school was, like, officially, transitioning to online. Things were still up in the air. And there was, like, I was still thinking, like, oh, like, I'll still be living on campus for another month. And I think even though, like, we had already known about COVID in China for a long time, we had just kind of assumed it would never happen to us, or at least that was kind of the general narrative I was really seeing around with people. And again, like, you know, there are a lot of things to discuss here about, like, the xenophobia and the idea that, you know, if something like this happens not here, then it's fine, then it's something that we don't really pay attention to, and that is kind of it was really made like the butt of many jokes at the time. And then now that it's, like, around the world, it's something that's very serious. So that's something to consider. And I really think, like, schools weren't ready, even though it, like, we kind of saw it coming. But, like, especially when you look at for primary schools and, like, public schools, I think the fact that school is still continuing offline, like, I definitely understand the daycare aspect of it. But at the same time, it's like, are we putting kids at a risk? Is something, because I don't think it was ever considered, or it was, like, seriously considered. Again, I'm not, like, in the ministry, so I can't tell you what they thought when they were making these decisions. But they made it pretty clear from the get-go that they weren't considering transitioning online. They were going to do everything in their efforts to keep things still in person. What are your guys' thoughts on that?
I would say it's funny you bring all of that up, because a big part of what people point to when it comes to the luck of BC during the first wave was the fact that school holidays were sort of in place when cases started exploding, right? Because BC school holidays are a little, you know, I think 1 week before the rest of Canada. So that sort of saved children and parents moving around, and that when the stay in place orders happened, it's not like people were moving around at all. So yeah, it's funny you bring all of that up, because the school holidays was sort of the reason many people point to as why we avoided the worst of it, at least at first. But, you know, we saw record death numbers yesterday, and, you know, the province were really hesitant to put in mask orders. And even for a few weeks, Dr. Bonnie Henry was reluctant to even recommend wearing masks. And, you know, contact tracing, there's been all sorts of things that have sort of unraveled over the past few months. So, I don't know. Schools were certainly a big part of it. I sort of see where Bonnie Henry is coming from when she says that there haven't been too many big outbreaks linked to schools. Most of it has been long-term care and, you know, service industries and stuff like that. But yeah, nonetheless, it is concerning that, you know, kids are being sent out for in-person stuff even now. So, and like, they didn't even extend the winter break for them as they've done for UBC students. So, go figure, right?
Another thing I've been thinking about is how, like, I think a lot of Western countries, or at least like Canada and the States, didn't really learn from China's experience, even though they experienced the worst of COVID like months before it hit us in the same way. And a lot of things, like you mentioned, how the mask order wasn't like implemented until recently, and we've been kind of just waiting for quote unquote the scientific proof from our scientists to come out. And even though, like, you know, Chinese officials have been saying you should be wearing masks, you should be doing this, we kind of really didn't take that into account. And I think we could have learned from them, and I think that would have made a difference if we had like started taking it, I guess, more seriously and done, even if like just like done more precautionary measures. And it's easy to say that with like the hindsight, but I do think it would have made a difference. I think,
yeah, I mean, I forget who the WHO official was that said this, but if you don't act fast when it comes to public health and crises like this, then you will have lost. And there's a really good video going around about that. And I think that's what happened, especially in North America, right? I mean, you saw in Vietnam, China, in New Zealand, I mean, they do have advantages that we don't have. But nonetheless, you have to see that the fact that they're largely back to normal, and they're having raves in New Zealand now. Like, what I'd give to listen to really bad music in the presence of 10 million people on drugs, I would not say. But yeah, like, precautionary lockdowns and mandatory masking, and in fact, like, relief to stop people from going to work in the beginning would have been in a much, much better position. But, you know, it's funny we say all of this because, you know, people who are on CERB are being told to pay their CERB back because they were ineligible. So, like, I mean, the attitude of, this is a known fact, but the attitude of, like, neoliberal countries when it comes to stuff like this is a known quantity, right? Like, you don't want to show the effectiveness of good governance to your people, otherwise they might start expecting things of you. What a shock. So, yeah, I completely agree with that. Like, we shouldn't be saying, like, we shouldn't be pointing to much smaller countries. We should be leading from the front, whatever we even mean in this context. But, you know, I'm not one to talk. It's not like India's doing any better. So, yeah, as we approach the end of the year, it's something I really think about. Like, a whole year sort of wasted would have looked much different.
Yeah, like, we talked about this before, but just, like, 2020 feels like the lost year. Like, this year has just been moot. Like, And that's something people are going to have to reconcile with. It's so weird to be, like, quote unquote, like, living what's probably going to be in history books down the line. And it's a very surreal experience. And it's hard to remember a time where we could actually see each other in person. But
a such part of me feels like it is still March.
I feel that. I don't think I've really progressed since then. But it's like the timeline has moved. And so I'm trying to reconcile and I'm trying to be like, wait, what did I do? I did nothing. And that's very scary.
Indeed. Yeah, it's been a weird year for everyone, I think. And even if I get the vaccine tomorrow, it's not like, even if I could, I would go outside and do anything, really. I'm still going to be hesitant to be within proximity of anyone for a while yet. And I think the wider effects of this on society at large are going to be very interesting to say. But yeah, I don't know if there's anything else anyone else wants to bring up.
Just before we close, I want to mention, I don't think, I mean, obviously we're having the vaccines come in, but obviously it's going to be some time before they can actually get, injected into people. And then, I do think there's a lot of hubris, and, I remember, going on a bus ride once, because I had to, in the middle of the pandemic, and it was, crowded. And we were just squeezed next to each other. And a lot of people weren't wearing masks. And that was kind of just because I had been in the suburbs before that. And, you know, I've been in my car. So I was like, oh, that's fine. But then actually going downtown and seeing that, people have been living life as if nothing has changed has been concerning. So I don't really have high hopes, even though, fingers crossed, I really want this to be over soon.
Yeah, and I think something that really needs to be mentioned is that if we get the vaccine, there are some studies which are showing that you can still spread the virus. So you could be safe from the effects of it, but you could still spread it to someone who isn't vaccinated against it. So yeah, we're gonna have to wait for community spread to come down even if we get the vaccine tomorrow. Community spread isn't slowing down in BC anytime soon, even though we've been under lockdown for the longest time. So, yeah, very, very great stuff to end on there. No optimism, only pessimism. That's the on-the-point way, baby.
Grim.
This too shall pass. To pull out a cliche. Yeah. Eventually, it will no longer be March.
So that's our show. Thank you so much for listening. This has been On The Point by CITR News. We're here every Friday at 10 a.m. bringing you local news. And stay tuned for more amazing programming.